Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Russ Avison right here on LA Talk Radio.
Oh my gosh, here we are. Welcome to The Writer's Block. I'm Russ Avison, and tonight I have the sincere pleasure of welcoming Richard Palinelli to join us. Boy, I just washed my lips and I can't do a thing with them. I'm sorry.
That's
Richard,
okay.
How are you tonight?
Not too bad. Not too bad. And trust me, that is not the worst mangling of my last name I have ever heard. So you're fine.
I practice it all day. I don't know what happened.
It's the O. It gets everybody. It's like this black hole. It just sucks you right into it. And you're gone the rest of the pronunciation. Yeah. No, I'm doing fine. Just hanging out here in Omaha.
Well, I wouldn't brag about that. Although, actually, I would, because I'm in California and we're cooking and burning and it's a mess out here. Our governor just declared a state of emergency yesterday because the fires are so bad.
Yeah, I can just imagine. We're sitting here in this 86 degree weather. I mean, you know, what are you going to do?
I think it was 101 just before we went on the air.
I would not be surprised.
So anyhow, tonight first of all, this was one of my most fun books. I cranked this book out in about 2 days just because it was one that wouldn't let me set it down. And every moment that I had, I picked up the book and read another couple chapters. So tonight we have Steve Barry. Steve Barry is a New York Times and number one internationally best-selling author of the Cotton Malone novel series, including the 15th book in the series, The Warsaw Protocol. History lies at the heart of every Steve Barry novel, as it is his passion that he shares with his wife, Elizabeth. This passion led the two to create History Matters, a foundation dedicated to historic preservation. Born and raised in Georgia, Steve is a graduate of the Walter F. George School of Law at Mercer University. He was a trial lawyer for 30 years and held elective office for 14 of those years. He's a founding member of International Thriller Writers, which is a group of more than 4,500 thriller writers from around the world. Steve Barry, welcome to the Writer's Block.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, we are so thrilled. Oh, look at that.
We woke up our audience.
Yeah, well, and nowadays, you know, with the pandemic, all of the audiences are fake, so everybody can have equal amount of applause.
That is true. That is true.
So, Steve, first of all, when I started this book, I didn't know that there was a series of 15 of them now. And this Cotton Malone, where did he come from?
Well, he came to me one night. I was in Copenhagen. I was eating dinner at a place called the Café Nordon, which is located in Hybro Plads, which is one of the squares in Copenhagen. And it's a lovely night. The windows were open, sitting up on the second floor. It's beautiful. And he just kind of popped into my brain. This retired Justice Department agent who now lives in Copenhagen, owns an old bookshop right there in Hybro Plads, and gets himself into trouble all the time. And he was born in a book called The Templar Legacy, which came in 2006. And as you said, we're now on the, here we are, you know, with the 15th Cotton Malone, and, you know, 16 books, here we are, later. And he keeps going, which is great. It's quite gratifying to see that he's caught on and he's there.
You're kind of like Lee Child's knocking out a Reacher book every year.
Kind of like that. That's right. I mean, Lee started before me. Lee's probably about 5 years before me. He was when he had the first 5-6 years when the first Reacher book came. And so, yeah, we do one a year. When we started, it was all one a year, and I still only do one a year because that's all my brain can handle. These books require an enormous amount of research. I use 300 to 400 sources to write each novel.
Wow.
So, can you give us a little thumbnail sketch of the Warsaw Protocol?
Well, it's an interesting idea that came to me when I was in Poland. I've been wanting to do a book with Poland for years. I love the country. I love the people. It has a fascinating history that most people don't know much about. Poland was an amazing country. It was literally wiped from the face of the earth in 1795. They divvied it up and got rid of it, but the country came back. It's been wiped from the face of the map several times, but it keeps coming back. And I had this idea. I wanted to work a novel with it. And so this deals with something from the Cold War, something real, something I think the readers might be a little surprised about that they didn't know actually existed. All of my novels are that. We take something from the past, something that's real, and I weave a modern-day thriller around that thing from the past because still whatever I pick from the past, it still has to matter today. And the Warsaw Protocol was fun, because I was able to combine a lot of things from Polish history and then a lot of things from the Cold War to put it together. And I was able to incorporate the salt mines located outside of Krakow, which is one of the neat places in the world. So I had some great locales. I had a good so what. I had a pretty good what I call the ooh factor, the thing that kind of makes you go like, ooh, that's pretty cool. And the novel just kind of came together, and I was able to pull it off.
Well, I'll tell you that you talk about the salt mines, and I will not give anything away about this book. But in the salt mines, there's a scene where they're in the salt mines and it's dark, and the only light they have are these lanterns on their head. And
yeah, I did that.
You did that?
I did it. Yeah.
Didn't it creep you out? I thought all I could think of was the light going out, and I'm down here, and there's all these different paths you can take, and I'm stuck, and I would die right there.
We were down there. I went there to do the research, and the people were very nice at the mine, and they took us down, my wife and I down, to level 9. 900 caverns that were carved out, you know, those particular caverns were carved out about 200 to 300 years ago. And we're in there, and the good thing about the mines there is they ventilate them. So you have a lot of air moving over you all the time. The reason why they ventilate them is because moisture is the enemy of a salt mine. If you let moisture accumulate, the salt will deteriorate. So they have to keep them dry. So that's the good thing is I'm not real fond of enclosed spaces. I'm not a fan of it. But I didn't have a problem down there. The caverns are open. The air is blowing over you. But literally, if you cut the lights off, you can't see your hand touching your face. That's how absolute black it was. Totally silent. And they took me into these caverns that were carved out during the Cold War, and they were used to store stuff, and no one knows really what they stored there. And so that allowed me to use those caverns however I wanted to, since no one really knows. They know they used them, but they don't know what they used them for. They're still there. The shelves are corroded away, but you know, the caverns are there, and it was quite remarkable. And all that's incorporated into the novel that we, you know, what we experienced down there.
Well, I found that part pretty creepy.
I was a little freaked out when I came down the elevator. I mean, it's a long ride down on the elevator, 900 feet underground. And, you know, you get off down there and there's just nothing down there. I mean, there's no way out. The only way out is up through that elevator shaft.
So if the power goes out, you're in trouble.
Well, the thing is, they have some lighting down there, but not much at level 9. Now, the mines are really cool up on levels 2 and 3. They built a city down there. It's like you're in a shopping mall when you go down there. It's amazing. They have a spa, they have a restaurant, they have a convention center. Quite remarkable and very accommodating. You literally feel like you're in a mall. But when you leave levels 2 and 3 and get down to level 9, it's a whole different world.
Okay, then the next question that which I won't say anything about, but is there a level 10?
There is not. I made that up. That's my creation.
Okay.
I needed a level where I wanted to do what I wanted to with. So I created the level 10, and where I could play with it and have whatever I wanted in there. I try to keep my books about 90% to reality. So I don't take liberties with reality. That 10% where I have to, because I'm writing a novel to entertain you. I'm not writing a textbook or travel log. So, but I still try to keep it as accurate as I can. And that's why I put that writer's note in the back of the book, because that's what tells you to view everything that's true or false in the writer's note.
Yeah, so, I found so, that really helpful too. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so nobody should be running around down there looking for this mysterious level 10 then.
Not level 10, no. There's okay. They only went down 9 there, and I needed to do some things. So it's just easier sometimes to make it up. And so I just created my own and sent it down there. And you know, it all depends. I try not to do that, but sometimes you just have to.
Oh, yeah.
So your characters, and not your protagonist, not Cotton Malone, but the ancillary characters that fall in here, how do you find and develop these? Because I some of the characters, I mean, like the two intelligence guys that or they dealt in selling intelligence or information, I think you called them. But how do you come up with a character like that and then make them so real? Because that was a real key part.
Yeah, each novel, you know, the good thing about writing a series is you don't have to reinvent the heroes every time because it's the same guy. But he does need to grow and change. Cotton Malone has evolved and changed a lot over the books. The bad guys, though, are new in every novel. And in this case, I had two information brokers. I learned about that. I didn't realize they had such a thing. But there are people in this world who literally peddle information. That's all they do. They sell information to governments, to companies, to whoever is looking for it, and they make a living out of that. So I created, you know, these two guys, you know, one of which is somewhat the antagonist of the novel. The other you don't quite know about, and I don't want to give anything away, but you don't quite know where he stands. And they hero than it is to create a bad guy. To me, it's a little easier to create a bad guy, because you can have a little more fun with it. You can be freer. You can do it. But here's the thing. Your bad guy's got to have good qualities. And your good guy's got to have some bad qualities. Because that's the way human beings are. So you have to factor those in. And in each novel, I've done 19 novels now. I had the 15 Cotton Malones, and I have 4 standalones. And each novel has a different bad guy. And I will tell you, it gets harder to come up with bad guys as you get going, because, you know, there's only so much you can think of to create these people. But this guy was very unique, and I was able to do that after reading about the information brokers. And I said, well, this is something new and fresh, and so I was able to incorporate that. Jonte Olivier is named after a guy who won an auction to have a character named in the book. And so that's where the name comes from. It's actually a real person who paid some money to a charity in order to get his name in the novel.
is he regretting that now, being that people will think he's partially that character?
No, he's not him. I tell people that all the time. This guy doesn't look like you, talk like you, or act like you. The only thing he has of you is your name.
Yeah.
And he doesn't. This guy has no relation to the reality whatsoever. In fact, I make a point to make sure that the character doesn't look like, act like, or talk like that person anyway. Now, Jonte was very pleased with it. He loved it. He thought it was great. He wanted to be a bad guy. He asked me specifically, says, I want to be the bad guy.
There you go. Well, in the sci-fi world, we call that red shirting. So, yeah, I'm glad to see it happens outside of sci-fi.
Yeah, we do that, and it's fun. And I name a lot of characters in the novels after people I know. It's not unusual at all for me to do that. It's unusual with the auction. I don't do the auctions anymore. That was the last one I ever did, and I don't do those anymore. But I do I just name people, characters after people I know.
Yeah. You know, talking about characters that you develop, the president of Poland is an interesting character that you've created, and you set him up the way you introduce us to him. You talk about the Cold War at a time when he may or may not have been at his very best, and it's that past that drives this story. And you connect it to Lech Walesa, who a lot of us remember from that time. And he kind of fell out of favor. So was that what you intended to do all along, or was it just in the course of research that you decided, hey, if I can connect what happened to this real leader in Poland and kind of tie it to what I want to do with this character?
And the Polish Polish president is another good example. It's Janusz Czajkowski, which is James Czajkowski, which is the real name of the novelist James Rollins, who's a good friend of mine. So, Jim Rollins, his real name is Jim Czajkowski, and so I named him the president of Poland, which was kind of fun. And he loved it. And I was very conscious of what happened to Lech Walesa. There was a lot of questions about his past. There's questions about what he may have done with the Polish Communist Party back in the 70s. There were several inquiries about that in the 90s and in the last 10, 15 years. All of that I became aware of in the research, and so I just incorporated that into my character and created it into him where I could tell it fictionally. But Lawrence's troubles are detailed in the novel that I doubt many readers will know much about. I know I didn't. I was very surprised at some of that.
I knew he had some issues, and it led to him falling out of favor and not being reelected. I didn't know the full story until I read your book. And it was like, oh, okay, that would make sense why this would have happened to him if. And that's a big if what he was being accused of was true.
Yeah, he says that he was working the party, that he was learning about things, that he was playing along with them to garner information and to learn his enemy. And that may very well be true. We will never know the truth of what happened back then.
Right.
But I can tell you one thing. The one thing, the worst thing you could call someone in Poland was a Soviet collaborator. That's probably the worst insult you could say to someone. But we'll never know with Walesa. It's impossible to know. He denies it. One court cleared him. Another inquiry did not. It's going back and forth. Some of those inquiries were led by his political enemies, so there's some bias in there. We'll truly never know the truth.
Yeah, it was interesting, too, though, as you mentioned in the book, you said even that one court had found it not true, the stink never leaves.
No, the stink, once the stink is on you, and I learned that from being over there, talking to people from people who have lived through that. And I learned that once you get that on you, it's hard to get off of you.
Yeah. Hey, Steve, we got to take a little break. You can hang in there with us?
Sure, I'll be right here.
All right. This is the Writer's Block, and you're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Hey, J. Michael here for LA Talk Radio. And if you're like me and you love talk radio, but you just can't find anything on that pesky little AM dial, then how about this? How about you tune into LA Talk Radio? You see, LA Talk Radio is a .com and they have it all, from music to sports to self-help. Put your feet up, tune into latalkradio.com and give us a listen. Guaranteed to be fun for you, and we're coming at you right now.
Right now. Thank you, J. Michael. If you're just joining us, this is The Writer's Block. I'm Russ Avison, and tonight we're joined with my amazing co-host, who I butchered his name in the beginning, Richard Palinelli, and New York Times bestselling author Steve Barry, whose latest book is The Warsaw Protocol. One thing I couldn't help noticing, Steve, is that President Fox, in your book, struck a lot of similarities to our current president. I thought.
Well, here's the thing about Fox. I created him in 2014. That's when he was created. And he was created as a counter to Danny Daniels, who was the president before him. And Danny was a totally different kind of guy. You can't have the same guy come in. You got to change him. So I changed him up. And there was a lot of traits I gave Fox back then that, interestingly, our current president adapted himself several years later, which is kind of weird. But I've been accused of that. I know I had a lot of readers who have written in and on the Amazon reviews and sent me emails saying all that. I didn't set out to do that. I created a character. He's a fictional character. I want to be able to change him and adapt him. Changing and adapting. Next year's book will be a little bit of a change for him. The book after that, he changes a little bit more. That's the whole thing when you create a character. You want to be able to change them. And they're mine. They belong to me. They don't belong to the world. They're mine. So I can mold them how I want. I've been accused also that he's named for Fox News. That's not true. He's named after high school. Did you? I got probably, I don't know, 200 emails that said, you named him after Fox News. No, I named him after a high school friend of mine.
Yeah.
Who has the name Warner Fox.
There's another
example of naming a character after a real person.
Did you ever look at the manuscript and look at what was going on in real time and go, you know, maybe I should make an adjustment? Or did you just say, no, this is it?
No, okay. But I mean, it was a lot of the traits. I'd say 90% of the traits that he has, I gave it to him long before 2016. And yeah. I kept those traits in him during that time period. And you know, now I'm not going to say that I didn't adapt a little bit of current stuff in there, because you want your book to be current.
Right.
I'm not going to sit here and say I didn't do that. But there is a little bit in there. But basically, 2016, which was I always thought was interesting, because they all accused me of writing this parody of him. I didn't intend to do that at all. I'm not writing a book to make a statement. I'm writing a book to entertain you.
That's a huge thing that I, you know, get behind myself, is that I want to read a book to be entertained. If I want to get preached at, I'll go to church on Sunday.
Right.
So, you know, I think it sounds like you agree with that.
I do, but I got accused of letting my politics come into the novel. Well, I can assure you, not a single reader knows anything about my politics.
Exactly.
Zero.
Yeah.
Zero is not in there. That character is just fun to play with. But as I said, he's evolving. He makes a mistake in this book, and we don't want to say what it is.
No.
And you know what it is. You read it. He makes a mistake. He makes a serious miscalculation that costs someone dearly. And that's going to haunt him more, you know, some more fun with him as that character evolves out. And so there's going to be more of that coming. Cotton Malone does not like Warner Fox. He does not.
No. That was pretty obvious.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
No, but he really respected Danny Daniels. So, you know, I wanted something the flip side of it. Mm-hmm. But as Fox is going to learn, you earn respect. You don't demand it. You have to earn it.
Right.
And so he's going to earn it. It eventually will happen. So there's changes coming to that character.
Right. Go ahead, Richard. I'm sorry.
I was just going to, because we brought up Danny Daniels, and there was something in the book that kind of caught my attention. I wanted to ask you about, especially with your background in historical research. You have Danny Daniels leaving the White House and becoming a senator in the U.S. Senate from Tennessee. And that has only really happened in real life twice. Well, for the Senate, it was Andrew Johnson, but John Quincy Adams back in...
Yeah, he did the House.
He went to the House. So, but the norm is the president gets done with his term, he goes home, and you know, that's it for him running for office again. And yet you have him doing that. So I was just wondering... you know, why did you decide to put Daniels back in the Senate?
I love Danny. He's a great character. I had him in many books. And then in The Lost Order, which was a novel about two novels ago, his term ran up in The 14th Colony, which is a novel that happened. And that's when Warner Fox, I created him. That's when Warner Fox was created, in The 14th Colony. And that was about four or three books ago. And then Danny Daniels goes out of office, and I didn't want to get rid of him. I liked Danny. He's got a way about him, and I said, I'd like to keep him around. So the Lost Order deals there, and so I've just kind of kept him there to use him. I will say that I'm probably going to phase him out a little bit more now as we get going and bring in some new blood, some new new things, like Warner Fox, who, as I said, is going to change and evolve and become a much more likable character, a much more character that you would admire. And you would say, okay, I can see that. So I liked Danny a lot. I just didn't want to chunk him away. But you know, there comes a point where you do have to fade him out and bring someone new. You know, every TV show does it. They take the long running TV shows, change out their characters. It gives the writers freshness. It gives the viewers freshness. So I'll be doing that here as well.
Yeah, it just kind of caught my attention because you had him. You had him doing something that hasn't been done in, I think, almost 150 years. So it was just something I wanted to ask you about, why you decided to go that route.
Well, the neat part was, is I was doing the research for The Lost Order, and I came across Andrew Johnson actually did it. I didn't know that. And Andrew Johnson was from East Tennessee, which mm-hmm. is where Danny Daniels is from. It was like, wow, what a coincidence.
And Andrew Johnson only lasted in office about 4 months before he died.
Yeah,
so.
he never even made it to the Senate. He died. He was appointed, but he died before taking the position.
Yeah.
It brings up an interesting question for me to hear an answer to. I know that you and Richard are both writers. I am not. You talk about the changes that you're going to make in President Fox in the future. Once you got started with the series of books, maybe you had two or three under your belt and you saw that this was something that was going to continue on. How far in advance did you think about the story arcs of what was going to happen with characters or maybe even your plot lines that were going to go to the future?
And thinking. Sometimes I'll go three, but I think about at least two. I will say, though, it changes so much. But I do have the arc. Like, I know I wanted Danny to go stay around. I knew I wanted to use him in some of the novels. And this particular novel, he's a great intro to have to bring in and bring it into play. It worked out, you know, perfectly to be able to use him. So I do think ahead. This is a series of books, but here's the neat thing about the Cotton Malone series. You do not have to read them in order. I write them so that you can pick them up in any sequence and read them in any sequence you'd like. If you read them in order, you might recognize some things along the way, but if you don't read them in order, you won't be irritated that somebody knows something you don't. I hate that when you're reading a series and they're talking about all this stuff and I didn't read the 14 books before.
Well, I'll tell you, your method is working because this is the first one, the only one that I've read, and mm-hmm. I did not feel alienated at all. I felt right from the beginning that I got into it and I felt it was all fresh and as if it was the only book.
Thank you. And I learned that from Lee Child. Lee taught me that. He said, every book in a series has to be the same but different. That's what you got to do. Same but different. That's a tall order, by the way. And keep them where they're not, you know, that they're episodic. You know, they're not a series where you have to read everything in sequence or you're going to be lost. They need to be episodic, but they also need to be somewhat familiar for people who do read them one after the other. And so, you know, in my case, same but different is same is action, history, secrets, conspiracies. That's the same in every book. Different is a different time period, different thing, history, different bad. So that's how I keep it the same but different in each one of them.
And that's a balance that's kind of hard to maintain, especially when you're talking, you know, 15 books into a series.
It begins to wear on you. They get harder, harder and harder. Thank goodness I'm okay, though, for the next 4 or 5 years, I think. I'm okay. I think I'm okay to about 2024, 25. I'm all right. But, you know, every time I think I'm not going to get another idea, where's another one going to come from? One comes. And so I just be patient. The one thing I've learned, the one place you will never find an idea ever is when you go looking for it. It has to find you. It has to find you. And so the trick is to be where it can find you. That's the one thing about this pandemic that's been really, you know, really frustrating for me because I travel a lot. We go to Europe times a year. I'm supposed to do that. So we're basically, you know, I haven't been on travel and I won't get on an airplane again until next August, if then. And that's been a little bit frustrating because travel is where I refill the imagination bank, where I get things fresh in my head, where I can keep going forward.
Yeah. Just a quick reminder, this is the Writer's Block on LA Talk Radio. We are talking with author Steve Barry. But real quick, we want to tell you about another friend of ours, All Dogs Rule. All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepovers is the place your dog wants to be if they can't be with you. Next time you need to be away from home and can't take your four-legged friend with you, let him stay at All Dogs Rule. All Dogs Rule is a cage-free camp environment where your dog gets to run and play with other dogs among orange trees in the country setting of Fillmore. Round-trip transportation is available. When your dog turns was better, yeah, it's the dogs. Visit All Dogs Rule on the web at alldogsrule.com or give them a call at 805-524-1100.
Well, Steve Barry, I have one last question about the book. And then I think we should get in a little bit to more about your process. But when you, and actually maybe this is partially a process too, is that when you start a book, do you already know where it's going to end and you fill in the gaps as you go? Or Jim has told me that there's pantsers, that just, I guess, right by the seat of their pants, and then there's the planners that have everything laid out.
Yeah, here's the thing. I get asked all the time, where do you start a novel? Where do you start a novel? There's a simple answer to that. You start a novel as close to the end as possible. So what does that presuppose? You need to know the end. Now, you don't need to know every detail of it, but you need to know generally where it is so you can get as close to that moment as you can. Now, for me, that's about 24 to 48 hours for me is where my novel. I've done one at 2 weeks. That's the longest one from the Charlemagne Pursuit, was a 2-week time period. But most of mine are between 24 and 72 hours in there. And so I know generally where the end is. I don't know the specifics. I did one novel where I did not know the end, and it was a problem. I had to do enormous amount of extra rewrites, you know, once I figured out what the end was to be. So, you know, I outlining is great. It's wonderful. I don't have the time anymore. And after 20 novels, I've kind of got the hang of it where I don't have to outline, but I do outline about 50 to 100 pages ahead of myself. I don't outline the whole novel. It would take too much time. But I did do it in the beginning. I would outline the whole novel. So writers out there who are starting out, you got to learn the hard way first. And once you get that, then you can go and do it the way. I'm kind of a hybrid now. I outline, but I also fly by the seat of the pants a little bit too.
Yeah, I think we all do that. My first creative writing instructor said that you want to get the ending written first, and then you work your way back to where your starting point is going to be. And now you know where you're starting from and where you got to get to, because otherwise you're going to wander off. Like you said, you're going to wander off, and then you're going to have all sorts of trouble trying to write yourself back out of the corner. So I agree with that. You have to know the ending first. Otherwise, it's a mess.
Well, it comes out just a mess. Like I tell people, it's like going on vacation. I've got 2 weeks to go on vacation. I have no idea where I'm going to go. I'm just going to get in the car and road and drive. Well, you're going to waste a lot of time driving around. But if I know I'm going to get in the car and I'm going to go to Disney World, I'm going to go to Magic Kingdom one day, I'm going to go to Animal Kingdom another day, I might change that up a little bit, but I've got a general idea of where I'm going to go.
Yeah.
And a general idea of what I want to do, I'm not going to waste as much time as I would be just riding around in the car looking for something.
Yep. I heard one time somebody said that if you don't know where you're going, you're going to get there real fast.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
All right, so now I'm curious about this. You were a trial lawyer for 30 years. And by the way, what elective office did you hold for 14 years?
I was a school board member, and I was a county commissioner. I was a school board member for 4 years and a county commissioner for 10 years.
Wow. Okay. So I'm going to guess you had successful, without getting too personal, but you probably financially set yourself pretty well after you retired from law. So now you're writing. My guess is you're writing. I mean, obviously, we all like to make money, but is it just more of a passion for you?
It's a little of both. I mean, I write. The reason why I write is simple. It's what every writer would answer. You write because you have to. You have a little voice in your head that tells you to write. It doesn't tell you to write bestsellers and sell a bunch of books and all that. It just says, I need you to sit down each day and write. If you'll do that, I'll shut up. If you don't, I'm going to nag you to death. And every writer I've met in the world has the same little voice. You're not born a writer. No one's born a writer. It's an acquired skill. You have to teach. You have to learn the skill. You have to acquire it. But you are born with the little voice. And that's the difference between writers. This is a living for me, though. And I say all the time, it depends on the goal of the writer. My goal was to be a commercial fiction writer for a New York publishing house. And that's what I do. I write novels for a wide audience that are in 51 countries around the world and, 40 languages. And they play well wherever you have them. They're high concept stories that can relate all over the globe, because that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to have an audience, a wide audience of to read my stories and to make money for a New York publishing house and to make money for myself. But let me get that clear. I did not go into writing to make money. That never occurred to me. You're right. I was a lawyer. I practiced law. I did very well. I didn't quit the practice of law until book eight. So, wow. You know, I did. I was seven books in. Book eight is when I stopped, only because it had just consumed so much time. At that point, I had to literally choose between the two. I didn't have the time to do both anymore. And so I chose writing. It was scary as hell. But, you know, because what if it fails? You know, it's terrifying. But luckily for me, it worked out. But so I don't write for the money. I appreciate the money. I enjoy the money. It's wonderful. I write because the little voice tells me to do it.
And if you try to ignore him, that little voice will get after you while you're asleep in your dreams too. Yeah,
constantly. Yeah, I've been at this now 30 years. I've written around 3.5 million words, and the voice still drives me crazy all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's good. Now, the name of your show is Writer's Block. You know, it's ironic because I don't really believe there's any such thing as writer's block. If we all get stuck. We all get stuck all the time. That's normal. I mean, I get stuck 50 times a day. You know, you just go outside, do something, walk around, do whatever you got to do, clean your head out. It passes. True writer's block is when the little voice in your head quits talking to you. And then you're done. You're finished. It's over. And I know writers who the little voice has quit talking to them. And that's when it's over for you. So hopefully with me, that won't happen anytime soon. It's still pretty strong in my head.
Yep. That would scare the hell out of me if that little voice shuts up on me. So I don't even want to think about that.
No, I like that little voice. I ignored it for 10 years. You know, for all during the 1980s, I ignored the little voice. I didn't write my first word till I was 35 years old in 1990. And then I wrote 8 manuscripts over 85 times. I made it on the 86th time, 12 years after I started. And the only thing that kept me going during that time was the little voice in my head.
What did you find that made the difference that 86th time paid off?
The world changed. Nothing. I didn't change. The world changed. You got to understand, what I was writing was called a spy novel. And in 1990, that genre died. When the Cold War ended, the genre ended. Now, if you were Le Carré or Ludlum or Cussler or anybody like that, you were fine. But if you were trying to start out, that genre was over. And by 2000, it was dead and buried and forgotten. And then in 2003, Da Vinci Code came, and the Da Vinci mm-hmm. Code brought the genre back to life. But it came back not as a spy novel, and that's exactly what I was writing. And so on the 86th time, Mark Tavani at Random House was looking for something to go with the Da Vinci Code, and I was in the right place at the right time with the right story 12 years after I started. It's the poster child for Don't Give Up.
That is awesome. That I love that story, and
yeah,
I think anybody doing anything in their lives, whatever your career is, it's kind of the same thing. You know, you got to stick with what you're doing. If you believe in it, the passion is there, and just don't quit.
And the world changed, and all at once, these stories became exciting and. Editors wanted them again. I was bought in spring of 2002. Da Vinci Code was bought at the same time. Now, Da Vinci wasn't until Marvel 3. So no one knew Da Vinci was going to be what it was when they did that. They just felt like they had something fresh and new, and the booksellers who were reading it liked it, and they thought they had something, and they were getting ready for it. And sure enough, they were right, and it did.
That's awesome. Hey, Steve, we got to take one more break. And if you don't mind hanging in with us, everyone, you're listening to The Writer's Block with Russ Avison and Richard Pellinelli and, of course, Steve Barry. We will be right back.
You know, when Creative Edge Publicity was founded in 2016, they immediately showed they weren't the same as other publicity firms. No, they work closely with their individual clients' needs and goals and push harder to get them noticed. Creative Edge believes that communication is an important part of the partnership. They collaborate and work with local, national, and international media outlets and organizations to meet their clients' goals and needs. So Creative Edge, it's your brand and your future. Mickey Mickelson, publicist, www.creative-edge.services.
We are back with Steve Barry. Steve, I want to ask you real quick about the next Malone book coming up. It's called The Kaiser's Web, and you deal with a very interesting historical question regarding Hitler and Eva Braun and Martin Bormann. I got to ask you, where in the world did you come up with that idea for the next book?
I've had this idea in my head for a long time. I've been wanting to do it for a while. And it's something interesting. There's a little bit why I twisted up. Again, the writer's note in the back of the novel is going to tell you that. But I just wanted to explore it. I wanted to do this. I've been wanting to do this from World War II for a long time. And it's an interesting story, but it also ties in very much with what's happening in Europe today and what's going on in Europe today. So there's that so what, where it still has relevance today. Mm-hmm. And I wanted South America in a story for a long time, and I've got it in this book, in The Kaiser's Web. So, you know, the book goes to, comes from Germany to South America to Switzerland to Austria. It's a lot of good. Oh, South Africa's in the book. I wanted that in the novel very much as well. So it's got some great globe hopping for Malone and a very, very cool ooh factor and a fascinating so what that I think the reader's going to go, I had no idea. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it comes out in February, I think.
February 23rd is when it's
okay. So I'm interested to see what theory you come up with regarding those three characters.
Yeah, there's a lot to it that's historically correct. I made a little twist because it's a novel, trying to entertain you again. But there's some interesting things about it real, particularly with Martin Bormann. Bormann, we don't have no idea what happened to him after the war. He fled the bunker right after Hitler died. It's said he was killed by cannon fire when he was trying to escape Berlin. They supposedly found his corpse in the 1970s. They ran DNA on it in the 90s and declared it was him, yet they immediately cremated the bones and scattered them in the North Sea, which is fascinating. Yep. You know, no one knows what happened to Martin Bormann. They truly don't know. There's a lot of interesting things, but there's also some interesting things about what he set in motion before the war ended, which I had no idea about, that I think the reader's going to be fascinated with. That is real and actually did happen.
Well, you know what? I hate to say it, but we are just about out of time. Steve, if you would let the listeners know about your books, where they can find them, if they want to contact you, if you've got Facebook or email or however they can reach you.
Yeah, I have a website, steveberry.org. There's a contact form there, and it comes straight to me. So you can send those. You can contact me from steveberry.org. All the books are there. Everything's laid out. We also have a Facebook fan page. That's how we do a Facebook fan page. I don't do Twitter or anything like that, but I do have a fan page there. But the best way is go through the website, and you can check out all 19 novels that are there. Next year will be my 20th book.
They flipped that.
That's pretty cool. I'll be honest with you, when I wrote the first one, I just wanted to be able to get to do it a second time and to do it a third. I always could I just keep doing this? And now here I am 20 books into it, and you just have to pinch yourself. You know, only in America, you know, after 85 rejections, you know, and I get to do it now for a living. It's fun.
Do you write every day?
I do, yes. That little voice wouldn't let me do that. Anything. Mm-hmm. I try to do my 1,000 words each day, yes, very much. Just 5 days a week, though. I work on the weekends if I feel like it. If I don't work on the weekends, I don't feel bad about anything. The little voice can't shame me. But during the week, I have to work. It's the job. It's not a matter whether I feel like it or not. You got to get in there and go to work.
All right. Well, listen, we really appreciate you joining us tonight. The author is Steve Barry, and the book is The Warsaw Protocol. I highly recommend it. And if you like, as Steve said, you like spy novels, it's right there. It's up at the top for sure. And that's why it was a New York Times bestselling book. We hope that you'll join us after the next one comes out.
I'd love to. We'll love to come back and we'll talk about the Kaiser's Whip.
All right. Sounds terrific. Again, Steve Barry, thank you so much. You have a great night.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Richard.
Yes, sir.
That's pretty awesome, huh?
Yeah, I'm actually really eagerly waiting for February because I want to see what he does with that little piece of history. Because you turn on the History Channel, half the time they're talking about what happened in the final days of World War II and what really happened as far as with Hitler and Bormann. So I'm interested to see what his take's going to be.
Well, I think I'll be reading a few of these. I thoroughly enjoyed this. This was a lot of fun. And his books are available on Audible, too. I saw it. I was tempted to get the audio version because I've been doing a lot of driving lately, and I thought, well, maybe it'll be a little easier. But you know what? We've been getting our books as PDFs so often that when I actually got this hardcover book, I thought, no, I want to enjoy actually touching this book and turning pages.
There you go.
You know what it is? It's a different experience. I didn't think it would be, but after reading so many on the tablet and then going back to a book, a hardcover actual book, it's so different. And the experience is much better, I think, reading the book.
Yeah. The only reason why I have a tablet is because I do so much traveling that sometimes I have to leave the books behind, and it's just nice having them with me in some form. But yeah, I'm right there with you. I prefer that feel of the book in the hand as I'm reading it. It's hard to describe and it can't be replaced.
Yeah. Plus, you know, if you've got a Kindle or a tablet, oh my gosh, you know, you carry 1,000 books with you.
I think that's where my book count is right now on mine. I'm not 100% sure.
Wow. You have lofty hopes there.
Yeah. I do a lot of reading.
Yeah. Well, you know, because you're a writer.
Yeah, that's one thing writers need to do is read more. And don't think just because you're writing all the time, that means you don't have to read anymore, because you do. I can't even begin to list all the benefits of reading when you're trying to be a writer if you're just starting out. So,
excellent. Well, listen, it's been a pleasure having you join the show tonight with me, because I haven't had a chance to work with you, just the two of us. And it's been fun. And you have some really nice insights into the questions you asked. I really enjoyed that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I've enjoyed filling in for Jim these last 3 weeks, and I'm hoping he's going to be back next week.
I hope so. I told him, I said he needs to get home, and he just he texted me back. He says, "Yeah, you think so, huh?"
Yeah, I think he's had just about enough of where he's been the last few weeks. So hopefully he'll be back next week. And he and Bobby are going to have a great guest on next week. I've got to read the book for next week only because I'm in the bullpen just in case I need to come back.
Uh-huh.
But it's going to be a good show with Kathy Murphy. So hopefully Jim will be back and be ready to go.
All righty. Well, thanks again. And to everyone listening, we appreciate you joining us this week. And just remember, you've been listening to The Writer's Block. Have a great night.